This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
Their core message was, well, there were two core messages. One was stop the boats, which they can't do. So it was a complete lie to make that promise in the first place. The second was to save some money. Well, they failed to do that. So the two things that they set out to do, they've completely failed on. They've got no other policies that they brought to the table. So they're floundering around. And obviously, the political makeup of the Reform Group, frankly, it's like watching a circus.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
In this week's episode, a Reform councillor apologises for WhatsApp messages saying he wanted to punch a colleague on the jaw. We have reaction from Rachel Reeves' much-anticipated budget, and we take a look at local government reorganisation in Kent. I'm Simon Finlay, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who covers the borough and district councils.
Hello.
And Nikki White, who looks at what is happening at Westminster.
Hello.
This week's guest is Maidstone Borough Council leader Stuart Jeffrey of the Green Party. First up, Rob, what have you been looking at?
So this week, three phases of an 800-home development were given reluctant approval, meaning 497 homes, mostly houses but some flats, and some commercial units, will be allowed on a section of the Capstone Valley at the East Hill development. Three applications were before Medway's planning committee for phases 2, 3 and 4, phase 1 having been approved in May last year, for the reserve matters of layout and designs.
So why the reluctance?
Well, as with lots of places in Kent, housing development, and particularly large-scale developments, aren't particularly popular. The outline application for the whole 800-home East Hill site was initially rejected by Medway Council in March 2021, and there was a large-scale public opposition to it. However, it was taken to appeal and permitted by the Planning Inspectorate. These applications were a follow-up work which enables the development to proceed. The debate was quite muted, and Committee Chair Chrissy Stamp summed things up by saying, quote, "I understand the frustrations members may have about this planning application, but as you know, it lost us appeal and we have to have a planning reason to refuse it, which I can't see," end quote. Therefore, she said she would be reluctantly voting, as did all the other members, for it.
What have you been looking at then, Dan?
So today it's the very long-awaited deadline for Kent's local councils to submit their business cases for local government reorganisation to Whitehall. And all of Kent's authorities have been voting on their preferences in the past couple of weeks. And as such, I've been throwing myself back into the detail of all the different models and what the different councils want out of it.
Lucky you. How many options are actually on the table then?
So between Kent's 14 different local authorities, they've conspired to come up with no less than five separate proposals for how Kent will look after the reforms. The most popular option by far is the one known as 3A for three big unitary councils, East, West and North Kent. That option has been endorsed by Folkestone Hive, Maidstone, Sevenoaks, Tunbridge and Morling and Tunbridge Wells. There are two different variants proposing four councils called 4B and 4D. Their geographies are a bit different, but basically they both have East, West, North and Mid Kent unitary councils. And there are two more quite unusual options. Option 1A is Kent County Council's preferred one of one colossal unitary authority with three small regional assemblies, believe it. And Dartford and Gravesham councils have devised their own plan too, endorsed only by them for five different local councils, North, East, West, South and Mid Kent. And funnily enough, the northernmost one is a very, very small one, including almost just them.
Okay. Any idea which one will be chosen?
No, it's not yet really clear yet, but I think we can hazard a decent guess. I personally think it will be probably a version of the option for three unitary authorities. Mm. One singular council will be way too large. Five would be far too many. The proposals for three seem to align with what most people in Kent would generally consider to represent three distinct sort of geographical and economic areas, and they're not so big that they'd be, you know, impossible to run. But I do think it's worth saying that presumably the government has known for quite some time which option it would prefer from LGR in Kent. Despite that, to make it look like there's been this wide-ranging consultation, we've had the better part of a year of councils busying themselves coming up with obscure alternative proposals, using time and money to devise one which suits their interests best, likely in the knowledge that Westminster's just going to ignore it anyway. So it looks like this is all still going to come in 2028, and that'll be done and dusted by then. But I can't help but think a lot of time could have been shaved off if the government simply did its own research and just imposed a decision on Kent's councils in the first place.
Of course, yeah.
So Simon, what's been on your radar?
Well, the fallout from the Reform UK Suck It Up video at Kent County Council has rumbled on and on. A few days ago, we reported that a cabinet member, Peter Osborne, had used some less than friendly language on WhatsApp. Councillor Osborne, who was referring to a colleague who had leaked a video to the Guardian newspaper, which caused the whole furore in the first place, said that he wanted to punch that person in the face. And this was the day after the video went online and all hell broke loose around the Reform UK. And on the WhatsApp message, he wrote, "I'm hoping this mole is a bloke so I can punch him right in the jaw." Councillor Osborne stopped short of apologising for his words, but did try to explain his actions. And don't forget, the group chat that he was involved in had dozens of members and was speculating about who leaked the video to a national newspaper, in which the council leader, Lyndon Kemp-Karen, was heard sort of swearing and shouting at our members. But when we showed Reform that we had a screen grab of the message, a very swift statement came back, and it had Mr. Osborne saying, "I said what I said in anger at the betrayal of a number of individuals who had considered my friends and colleagues. I'm glad that distraction is now behind us and we are now continuing to deliver for people of Kent at lightning speed, saving tens of millions and fixing tens of thousands of potholes. However, I accept that there's never an excuse for violence. That was never my intention. My comments were made out of frustration and at the circumstances, which I'm sure many will understand, rather than malice." So not exactly an apology, but an explanation.
So is that the end of the matter?
Well, the Kent opposition leader for the Liberal Democrats, Anthony Hook, said that Councillor Osborne should go. But Councillor Osborne appears to be safe for now, from what I can understand. But I'm reliably informed that this is far, far from over. Right, Nikki, what's caught your eye this week?
Obviously, the focus at Westminster this week has been about the budget, but we're all going to talk about more about on that later. In the meantime, I've been looking at what Gillingham and Raynham MP Nishaba Khan has been saying about the hot topic of HMOs.
Okay, the number of properties being converted is just soaring at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It seems that barely a day goes by without Kent Online reporting yet another story about a large property being turned into shared accommodation. And Nishaba says in her constituency that the number of applications is unprecedented and there's no signs of it stopping. Now, to make it clear, not all HMOs need planning permission. Under current government legislation, as long as there are no more than six people living at the property, developers can turn homes into HMOs. It's only when that number is seven or more, or the authority has brought in its own additional restrictions, that planning permission is needed. But either way, there are more of these types of property emerging.
They can meet a need though, can't they, HMOs?
Yeah, they can. They really can. They're popular with the students, but also young professionals who might want nothing more than a room with a shared kitchen, and it's far cheaper than paying out for a flat. But some who live near these properties are getting increasingly fed up with seeing their community disappear around them, because inevitably people who rent these rooms are less likely to stick around. And people are also worried about increased noise, because there's more people, extra strain on parking, and possibly even criminal activity.
So what's Nishaba Khan suggesting?
Well, this isn't the first time she's raised this issue, but she's stepping up the pressure. She says her constituency of Gillingham is explicitly being targeted by developers because it ticks all their boxes. The property types, the housing demand, limited regulation and train links to London. It's all making it really attractive. Some property investment firms have specifically marketed Gillingham as a, quote, strong, low barrier opportunity for HMO investment, and others have stated that the streets of Gillingham are paved with gold. She says it has done little to address the local housing need, which does need addressing everywhere, but has started to change the fabric of our streets, housing what she says are vulnerable out of borough residents to meet the temporary accommodation needs of places like London. It sounds as if she's sort of like waging war on these things. She's not against HMOs per se. She says she's lived in one herself and she understands that they provide a valid option for students, young professionals and people who want to get into the housing market. But she wants to ensure that these properties are responsibly managed and integrated in a way that supports the community. So she's calling for better legislation so we can effectively manage them. She's urging on Medway Council to also consider an Article 4 direction, and that would remove the automatic permitted development rights for HMO conversion and would mean all future applications, no matter what size of the number of people going in, they would have to go through the full planning process. Now, places like Maidstone, which is also seeing huge numbers of HMO conversions, they've recently brought in stricter rules, so it'd be interesting to see what effect they have.
Okay, thank you, Nikki. Well, after weeks of leaking, the budget was finally presented on Wednesday by the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves. Dan, you keep a close eye on the economic picture. What did you make of it all?
Obviously, none of it was surprising because basically all of it has been leaked beforehand as a, what appears to be now increasingly active market management around the release of the budget. Regardless of the pros or cons or merits of any of any of the policies included in it. I think the pain and chaos associated with it definitely could have been avoided if most of this had just been rolled into the government's first budget after it took office last year. All of the speculation and all of the fears about balancing the books, you know, presumably Rachel Weisz did not think that the budget she set in 2024 would right Britain's economic woes so significantly that this budget in 2025 could be sunshine and rainbows. She must have known that. It seems like the first year round, she was just unwilling to make some of the perceived hard decisions. And also, I think, even if, you know, a lot of people are talking about tax rises, there is a de facto tax rise because the income rate, income tax threshold is going to be frozen for a further year. And as salaries gradually increase over time, that means more people are pulled into paying tax. So there is de facto a small tax increase on working people. But the problem is most of these policies, you know, tinkering with thresholds here or there, tinkering with percentages on kind of savings accounts, whatever, all of these are basically born of the fact that the Labour Party and no party in this country has the political authority to actually justify what is probably necessary, which is tax rises and quite radical redistributive measures and, you know, greater political control of things like interest rates through ending Bank of England independence, welfare to work programs, colossal borrowing to actually invest in infrastructure. There are all kinds of radical options available to the government. But after many, many decades of economic orthodoxy, they don't see any possible way of fixing it, and they don't have the authority to do so, even if they thought they could.
Robert, some pretty stark numbers have come up, but are things really that bad?
Well, from sort of discussions that I've heard from other people, it seems that, you know, despite all the sort of long-term briefing ahead of it and all the discussion that has been had around the budget, and it's sort of been quite a major news story of late, it's not actually that remarkable as a budget. It's kind of typical tax and spend and that sort of thing. I think one thing that was quite interesting to me was that there was kind of a perception that Rachel Reeves was really struggling to sort of balance the books almost, and sort of how high would she raise taxes because of a shortfall that she had. But actually, it turns out that she had some spare headroom left over just before this budget. Now she has, through the measures that she's introducing, she's increasing that to £22 billion. I think there's some interesting bits. I think the cuts to green levies to sort of reduce household bills, I read that that's going to reduce the average household bill by £150 for a family, which is obviously, you know, that's something that is quite significant. A lot of people are complaining about their bills going up. So in certain areas, there's things, I mean, fuel duty has been frozen for the 15th year.
Yeah,
running.
But then she's clobbering people who are saving in their pensions as well, isn't she?
Yes. And so it's a bit of a good take. I mean, she made a big thing as sort of has been, again, rolling the pitch of this budget of the two-child benefit cap being lifted. And a big part of her speech was about how the two-child benefit cap was keeping children in poverty. So there is a definite element, at least in the selling of this budget, to say we're looking after ordinary people. And, you know, the introduction of a mansion tax and properties over £2 million and then further on over £5 million. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a suggestion that this is about looking after, you know, poorer people rather than the rich.
Yeah. Nikki, anything leap out at you?
Yeah.
What about normal people?
Then this is it. I mean, we all know that the budget is important and there's so much detail into it, but people will only jump into sort of like the big headlines that affect them. And we all know we're going to get hit financially one way or another. And Rachel Reeves needed some of those big headlines to help ease the turmoil the government has been caught up in recently. I mean, many people don't feel that they've seen Labour deliver since they came to power. And that inevitably means that unless she'd stood up and said she was going to give us all £10,000 a year with absolutely no strings attached, and in return, she's going to make the NHS the best thing ever, this budget is always going to attract some kind of criticism. It was also pretty embarrassing, probably, that everyone knew what was coming before, because of the OBR leaked its report a couple of hours before she officially delivered her speech to the House. And even as Rachel Reeves was speaking, there was lots of MPs who were studying the report on their phone. But probably the big headlines for most of us were things like income tax and national insurance thresholds. They're going to remain frozen until 2031. As Robert said, the two-child benefit cap is going to be scrapped from April. Fuel duty is to be frozen until next September, but a new mileage tax is coming in for electric vehicles, which will come in from 2028. For parents, another good thing, there's £5 million for libraries in secondary schools and £18 million to improve playgrounds in England. And then, you know, something for all of us, a whopping £4.9 billion is going into the NHS. And you go, well, okay, so where's that coming from? She says that that's going to come from axing things like, as we've reported before, police and crime commissioners such as Kent's Matthew Scott. She referred to local government reorganisation, the changes there, and also selling off some government assets that we no longer have any use for, which it'll be interesting to see what pops up there. the hits are going to come to those who have the most money, as you mentioned. There's going to be a mansion tax coming in, with properties worth more than £2 million paying a surcharge of £2,500, and properties over £5 million a surcharge of £7,500. Not going to affect me, I say that. And anyone paying into their pension through a salary sacrifice scheme, they're going to see anything over £2,000 taxed. And if you've got an ISA, that's going to get an overhaul, with the limit reduced to £12,000 unless you're over 65. Now, there was a very, very brief mention, a Kent mention. She said they committed the investment to the Lower Thames Crossing. Mm. It was only one sentence, but it will give some certainty. No figures, nothing, just a commitment to it. And that will just give it a bit further certainty that that project's going to go ahead.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
This week saw the deadline pass for Kent's 14 councils to submit their proposals for how local government will look in the future. Those councils are likely to be replaced by a smaller number of much larger unitary authorities under the government's reforms. One of the council leaders getting ready to abolish himself is Stuart Jeffrey, leader of Maidstone Borough Council, and he's with us today. Hello, Stuart.
Hello. I'm just looking forward to abolishing myself.
Stuart, there are five possible proposals on the table for the minister to mull over. Which is your preference and why?
I mean, none of us really want LGR. None of us want to abolish ourselves. I think the idea of unitaries is fine, but the best option that we could come up within the rules that that were set by government was the 3A option, which puts Maidstone in West Kent. Now, there's some real risks about doing so.
And that would be alongside Sevenoaks, Tunbridge and Tunbridge Wells, yes,
absolutely.
So it'll be the four of you.
Tunbridge and Malling, let's make sure Malling gets a shout in this. So that feels like the best option. It's the best fit with other public services, particularly the health service, the health and care partnership. The majority of the budget for the new unitaries is going to be for social care. So aligning health and social care public sectors feels like a really sensible thing to do. So that's why I'm in favour of it. I quite like the idea of, I think it was 4D, to some degree, because, you know, I've always wanted a seaside in the council. But, you know, it doesn't meet a lot of the issues around the public sector, for example.
You hinted at there a second ago, but do you really support the whole idea of local government reform?
I'm not keen. I like the idea of unitary authorities. Bringing planning alongside highways is a really good thing to do. The way it's been pushed forward, these are big unitaries. They're going to be distant. For me, though, the prize is going to be devolution. We heard today more money going to mayors. Well, you know, Kent needs some of that money. Mm. And that, for me, is where we should be focused. Not so much at the LGR bit, the reorganisation bit, but actually we're doing this for a purpose, to get the money from central government so that we can do some stuff for Kent.
Mm. I mean, the government says that it will be cheaper in the long run, it'll empower communities and make them more autonomous and ultimately make the planning rules more relaxed. Government seems to think that more housing is a good thing, but judging by the roads around Maidstone these days, would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, that's part of the problem of having planning and highways in different authorities.
Yeah,
we've got Kent County Council constantly pulling in one direction and Maidstone Borough Council pushing in a different direction. I think the public would, in general, have a real issue around planning rules being relaxed because, frankly, most of the people I speak to want them strengthened. They want real control for the local authorities. Mm. And again, something we fight with constantly with national government. So, yeah, I think there are some very mixed benefits and disbenefits in doing this. But, you know, overall, getting planning and highways together is a good thing, and should mean in the future we can shape the way Maidstone looks and people get around Maidstone to the benefit of everyone.
Yeah, but do you buy the concept of, you know, more housing equals greater population equals growth? Do you think that equation works?
Well, I've never been one to aim for growth as an outcome, because frankly it just means more resource use, more population, more cars on the road. So I'm not overly keen, although I absolutely recognise there is a housing crisis, and that housing crisis is at the affordable level. It's social housing, which is why my council's pushing for social housing.
But that's not what the government wants. The government wants yet more of these sort of large scale developments that we're seeing in Swale, we're seeing in Maidstone, we're seeing it down in Folkestone and Hythe. Does that really work?
No, I don't believe so. I think the reason they want that is because they have economic growth as their goal, and I don't hold that goal, and therefore we are at odds. Mm. I think that economic growth, if it happens, should be a sort of side thing, and actually we need to be focusing on getting houses for people who really need them. Yeah. So I'm keen that we build those needed houses. I'm not keen on I really hate building mansions in the countryside, FYI.
Yeah, okay. I mean, if Maidstone is lumped in with the other West Kent councils, will the fact that there's so much green belt in some of those areas, like Sevenoaks, for example, will that just mean that Maidstone's going to cop a load more houses than even it that it doesn't want?
Yeah, I mean, that is the main risk. And obviously, the national government has ripped up some of the Greenbelt rules recently, which reduces that risk a little bit. What we are wanting to see is that mayor in place, and a mayor that says, actually, yes, if there's a requirement to build X number of houses across Kent, they can't all go in Maidstone. Actually, there are some other places, so that shifts around a bit more. Because ultimately, you know, the area around Maidstone cannot, as it sits at the moment, really support that. So I think there has to be something quite strategic that delivers housing in the places it's needed and in the places that can support it.
Okay. The Greens recently elected Zach Polanski as its leader. He appears to be very popular amongst younger people. What's he got the previous leaders didn't have?
Oh, he's got... Wow. This is where I upset my friend Adrian, isn't it? No, I mean, Zach really does sort of land that narrative in such a clear, simple way that resonates. And I know that kind of gets labelled as populist, and I know he labels it himself as populist, but he's able to express himself and get those punchy messages across in such a good way that that resonate with people. And frankly, I've been surprised over the last 20 years or so that we haven't managed to grasp, certainly the younger generation, people much younger than me, because actually all of our policies really do benefit them. So he's expressing them in that way. And people under the age of 50 are flocking to us, which is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, realistically, the Green Party can't win a general election, but how many seats
says
can
who?
It? The polls say it for a start, but I mean, realistically, you know, how big do you think the Green Party can be in the next parliament?
Well, the polls, a few of them recently, have put us second place in national polls, which, you know, I find quite astonishing, and I'm still trying hardest to believe them. But yes, clearly, when we've looked at how popular our policies are, we have the most popular policies. So if we're able to get them out, we can get bigger. Labour are collapsing. Lib Dems aren't going anywhere quickly. And the Conservatives are collapsing. So, you know, we could easily be the second party, and we could be leading a coalition, just as I'm doing in Maidstone. You know,
it's 5 years ago. It's so fluid at the moment, isn't it? It's volatile.
When I was speaking to you 5 years ago, the idea of me saying to you, I'm going to be leader of the council, you would have gone, yeah, right.
Well, I would. You're absolutely right. I mean, what do you think it is? What are the policies that seem to resonate so much with young people? Because that's where I'm picking it up from. I'm hearing young people are but there was one guy on the telly the other night, and he was saying that he couldn't work out whether he wanted to vote for Reform or the Green Party, because people are that sort of polarised from the main parties that they want some kind of radical difference. Why do you think that it the Green Party, what is it about the Green Party which actually attracts younger people?
I mean, I think it's our straight talking. It's the fact that we do have a care for the environment, and climate change is going to be one of the massive things that happens to the world over the coming decades. So we have got that eye to that slightly longer future. We are thinking about it, wanting to make some differences to make sure that the world is livable. There's something very clear about our sort of tax and spend policy. Moving away from taxing work to taxing wealth, I think, is a really strong message, because we've seen, particularly over the COVID years, the shift of wealth moving into the hyper-rich, the billionaires. That shift has been incredible. Meanwhile, younger people are struggling to find homes, struggling to find well-paid jobs and so forth. So they are really struggling financially in a way that my generation, our generation, probably didn't.
Yeah.
To look at sort of other sort of national elements, the budget this week, what's your sort of perspective on Rachel Reeves' performance today?
I mean, we're still getting our head around the list of stuff. There's some obvious takeaways from me that she's pushing growth. She's really quite giving up on net zero. I mean, the idea that you're making electric cars more expensive to run and making petrol cars cheaper. I mean, that just flies in the face of everything we need to do for the future, and it's self-defeating. The idea that you give you reduce some of the green levies on energy bills is really quite regressive. We know that those green levies that have been put in over the last 20, 30 years have meant that our bills are lower than they would have otherwise been. Yes, they're going up, but they would have gone up much more without them. So I think she's being quite dangerous with some of the stuff she's done, and it worries me.
Particularly one of the things that she sort of talked quite a lot about was the Anglesey investment in nuclear power. What's your views on that? Because in the last Green Party manifesto, it was sort of moving away from nuclear power or divesting from it. What do you think is the position now?
I mean, nuclear power is not a source that will help us tackle climate change. It takes decades to get a nuclear power station in place. I think, is it called Sizewell C? It's been on the cards for so long. It requires a huge amount of long-term storage. There are better investment opportunities. Wind and solar will make a difference now, and that could reduce our bills now.
Well, there was that video, you know, a couple of years ago. It came back. It was a clip from Nick Clegg, rather, in 2010, saying Sizewell C, it's going to take a decade to build. Well, if we'd started a decade ago, we'd have it by now. So these sorts of things would contribute, and nuclear power does not contribute to global warming. So surely I would have thought that the Green Party would support that sort of measure.
Yeah, but we need the changes now. And the money that it'll take to build that sort of nuclear power station, an opportunity cost that we could put into wind and solar. Wind is incredibly cheap to build. The return on it is phenomenal. Nuclear is expensive. So, you know, let's put the money where it'll make a difference right now, in a way that will produce clean energy.
And in terms of other things such as the two-child benefit cap and those sorts of things, the motability scheme, what are your views on the changes in those sorts of areas?
So the two-child cap, I mean, it's 18 months too late. This is something they could have done instantly. A third of children are in poverty, and they're going to stay in poverty until April. That change should have been made straight away. This is supposed to be a Labour government. They're supposed to look after the people. The fact that they kept this very, very regressive problem that damages families, the fact they kept it in place for so long, frankly, is disgusting.
Stuart, you were elected to Kent County Council in May as one of a handful of Greens against a massive number of Reform UK members. How would you rate the party and the leader's performance since they got in?
Well, they haven't done very much, have they? Apart from sow division and hatred. I really do struggle with the way that KCC is performing. The latest cabinet papers showed a £50 million overspend. Their core message was, well, there were two core messages. One was stop the boats, which they can't do. So it was a complete lie to make that promise in the first place. The second was to save some money. Well, they failed to do that. So the two things that they set out to do, they've completely failed on. They've got no other policies that they brought to the table. So they're floundering around. And obviously, the political makeup of the Reform group, frankly, it's like watching a circus.
On that note, Stuart Jeffrey, thank you very much indeed for your time. It was reported this week that the government is considering getting rid of juries for all Crown Court cases apart from murder, rape and manslaughter and cases that have a particular public interest. This was reportedly to tackle a court backlog of some 78,000 cases. We're joined by Matt Ramsden for this section. But first, Robert, what do you reckon? Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, personally, I'm against the idea. I think, you know, I want to start by saying, obviously, the backlog is a massive problem within the judiciary.
It's bad
system.
For everybody.
Absolutely. And there's loads of people who are waiting for justice, either because they've been accused of a crime or they have suffered a crime and they aren't seeing the person who perpetrated it put away. But I think the idea of getting rid of jury trials is a mistake, and it's actually it's not really a policy. It's a failure of a policy in that we haven't invested in our judicial system for many, many years. It's no one government or one party's fault, but you know we basically aren't funding. I mean, some of these, as you'll know, some of these court buildings are falling apart. They're in disrepair, and basically we're not getting through the cases as we should be. And I think if we had invested a long time ago and actually said, all right, well, it's important that trials go ahead and things get done properly, we wouldn't be in this position. We wouldn't have to be considering this.
Yeah, it wasn't actually explained very well. Maybe I wasn't paying enough attention. Didn't explain why having no juries would make them any faster, because at the same time, you know, if you have a judge hearing it, one judge hearing it, you still get the same amount of evidence, you get the same amount of witnesses, you get the same amount of court time that's going to be required. If you don't have enough court time and you don't have enough court space and you haven't got enough judges and you haven't got enough defence barristers and other legal representation which are in short supply at the minute, it doesn't seem to be anything other than a bit of a gimmick, really.
Absolutely. And there's an account on, I think it's on X, that sort of logs how many courts aren't sitting on any given day. And it, sometimes it's a huge chunk of courtrooms aren't sitting and aren't looking at any cases. I think if we invested in that sort of thing, then we could get through, you know, it might take slightly longer than if we had sort of a factory line system of no juries and just, you know.
Well, I suppose what it does, once the jury goes out to deliberate, I mean, they can be up for they don't stay out for weeks anymore, and they don't even stay out for days that many in that many occasions. But it would cut down that jury deliberation time, I suppose, and a judge would be able to rattle through the business of things that may be delayed by a jury. You know, jurors not turning up on time, or juries coming back with questions and points of order and things that need to be heard in camera away from a jury. All those things can be done without them. I suppose that will take some of the time away. And I suppose, but it does kind of smack of almost like being a diplomat court, in that they want to get justice as quickly as possible and as cleanly as possible.
And this unfortunately leads on to another problem, which will come up if they did get through those backlog, is there aren't the prison spaces for the people who need to go to prison. So it's a story of consistent underinvestment in lots of areas.
Yeah. Matt?
It's a system that's creaking at the seams. It's got real problems. I mean, you can say about getting rid of juries, will that actually affect the situation? But from our experience on Kent Online especially, we know that the court system is so badly run, it's unreal. Mm. When it comes to the logistics of operating every day, there's always problems. That might be issues with the juries, it might be a translator hasn't turned up, a translator hasn't been ordered, they haven't got enough lawyers, judge isn't sitting. It's an ongoing problem. So I think if they're talking about getting rid of juries to help get rid of the 78,000 case backlog, I think that's not a bad thing. If that
so
helps.
You're talking about something temporary, yeah?
Definitely. I mean, long term, I'm fully supportive of the whole concept of a jury. I think you should be judged by your peers. But I think something desperately needs to be done to get rid of the backlog. And the reason I say this is, coincidentally, when this news dropped on Tuesday afternoon about David Lammy looking at this issue, I just got off the phone to a guy who's been awaiting trial for 3 years for a very serious case. And this guy's broken. This guy's in tears because he just wants his day in court. He just wants it to be over.
Yeah. I know a criminal barrister who said that one of his clients that kind of got caught up in the, when he got caught up in the COVID delays, he said that, you know, this guy went to university, got married, started a family, and his case still hadn't been heard.
Yeah,
and you know, he joked that the actual exhibits got fossilised in the meantime, you know.
Yeah, but just imagine if you're a witness in a case and you're finally getting to give your evidence 3-4 years later. I mean, your memory, you know, is going to be completely different from then. But the whole system needs a desperate shake-up. Rob, you'll talk about the investment, which is clearly needed. But yeah, if this helps make sure the people, victims and the accused, have their day in court sooner, I think it's a positive thing.
Politicians do spend a lot of time sort of saying how the victims of crime really matter to them, but clearly they don't, because they've starved the justice system of the money it needs for decades.
I mean, you've got to look at things like COVID as well, which had a massive effect.
But the backlogs were happening before COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, the figures clearly show that.
It certainly didn't help.
No. And then they just rocketed after that, yeah. Dan?
I can at least understand the argument for it as a temporary measure to reduce the backlog, but I don't think it's justified to do that, and I don't think it's a good thing at all. The limitation of jury trials was something that the new Labour government attempted, and other than that, historically, it's only really been the franchise of highly authoritarian regimes to restrict the right to a jury trial, even in times of crisis. You know, the historic right to be tried by a jury of your peers rather than by a judge was created pretty much in England by Magna Carta, explicitly to prevent people from being victimised by the prejudices of an elite judiciary class. That elite judiciary class still exists, and it's all well and good to say, oh, well, jurors are basically stupid, but judges aren't perfect either. And I think absolutely everything should be done to make sure that the backlog is reduced without basically diluting the quality of justice which served. And the way to do that, build more prisons, build more courts, simplify sentencing, have them running literally round the clock. Judges get paid enough money. If it means they have to stay up till 5 a.m, literally, so be it. I think pretty much anything that can be done to protect the integrity of trial by jury, even if it massively inconveniences judges and legal bureaucrats, completely justified.
Mm. The world according to Dan Essen, eh?
Just to contradict what I just said, I've known so many people who've served on juries and have come away saying it was actually a terrifying experience because there were so many people sat on the jury who didn't have a clue what was going on. Mm. And I don't know if that's worth further discussion because... Should there be some sort of training? Should we have
brains testing?
Well, maybe. I don't know. I mean, one of our colleagues in the newsroom was saying that in Sweden they have professional jurors who have a knowledge of the law.
Yeah,
and they'll sit on all cases.
Yeah. Well, without wanting to sound like spending lots of money, particularly other people's money, I think again that's a case of investment. We should be investing in the education system in this country so that even the lowest quality juror still has the wherewithal to be able to sort of weigh up the evidence.
What do you mean? Almost like taught in school. This is what happens if you become a juror.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. Sort of understanding the processes. It could just be in a citizenship test or something like that, a general sort of way of being a citizen. But I think, again, investment is all the same. Although the suggestion that if it was temporary, that would be slightly better. Actually, I think that would make it even worse in the sense of if you're convicted in this sort of, say it's an 18-month period where where they got rid of juries just to get through this backlog, you forever will be able to say, well, I was only convicted because they were trying to get through all these cases really quickly. And I could foresee somebody saying, well, is there not a legal challenge to my conviction because it was under these sets of circumstances, which are now, we now accept was not a long-term good thing, and so it was only for a temporary measure. I don't know if that would be the case.
Also, I think persistent cultural failure to inculcate in people a sense of civic responsibility and the understanding of their responsibility to their society and to fellow citizens in the form of being a jury is not a reason to be sceptical of jury trial. It's a reason to be more in favour of it, to make it more that kind of civic participation and responsibility a more regular part of people's lives.
Okay, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Nikki, Matt, Dan and Robert for their contributions and to our special guest this week, Stuart Jeffrey. And don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage. You can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters and don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you then.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.